KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. You may know the Academy Award-winning actor Dustin Hoffman, who's sitting across from me. I'll just throw out a few titles for you, maybe some of my favorites. Oh, Agatha, a Papillon, certainly The Graduate, Kramer versus Kramer. His first film as director is the new film Quartet, an adaptation of the play by Ronald Harewood. Dustin, thanks so much for being here.
Well, thank you for inviting me. Well, All these years you didn't. I thought you didn't like me.
Yeah, I was just afraid. I could put these notes under your door, and you thought, oh, Elvis, he's dead. I don't need this stuff. But I know that it's when this show runs, it will be the 35th anniversary of a movie you almost directed, Straight Time.
Yes. Oh, I didn't realize it was that.
Yeah, well, which was for a long time unavailable on home video. What happened with Straight Time? Why did you end up not directing that?
I cast it. I cast the crew and the cast. I did my due diligence. I hung out with ex-convicts for over a year and a half. I got to know Eddie Bunker, who wrote the novel, No Beast So Fierce, which I think is a line from Shakespeare.
Absolutely, yeah.
As man himself or something. I actually was snuck into San Quentin after touring it about a half a dozen times.
But you sneaked into San Quentin? Usually people try to sneak out of San Quentin.
Yes. I was snuck in, and I was there for about 6 hours, dressed as a convict.
So you were in the general population when you were there?
That's correct.
Wow. What was that like for you?
It was different from being on a tour, because I'd done about six tours. Very briefly, I got to know the pastor and Eddie Bunker. He was out, but he knew people that were still in. So with certain conversations, there was a big room filled with convicts who were, and they like to be called convicts, they don't like the name, at least in those days, who were typing. It was before computers. And they were showing me the typing room, and this is where my engagement into the prison was going to take place. They took me to a bathroom, and in the bathroom I changed clothes. I was then snuck into the prison and attached to a guy by the name of Mike McNabb. He was doing life for blowing some guy's head off with a shotgun in a cocaine deal that went bad. And he was one of the higher-ups in the prison, and he was to be my, you know, my safety. And he took me around, and he showed me his cell. And in his cell, he pushed open the mattress, and then his shanks were there, what they called knives, all different kinds. He had a little ice box, and he opened it up. There was a big thing of ice, and he had steaks in there because he got special treatment, and he could make them right there in his cell. You didn't have to do any work. It was open cell policy. And they could watch TV all day if they wanted. There was a lot of drugs. And guards made barely, above poverty pay. And just before you went in the big gate, there was this long line of, be nice to call them apartments, but they were really one rooms, and that's where the guards lived. So they practically were convicts also.
The guards lived there too?
Yes, right outside the gate. And they averaged about a stabbing a week. 52 people died, something like that, a year. And in the yard, usually. There was no place where you were safe, and we put this little thing in the movie, and that is that if you were in segregation and behind bars, anybody could walk by and never went out. Anybody could walk by with a can of gas, throw it on you as you were sleeping, and torch you with a match. So you really felt that kind of, fear. When I was in the first hour, we were on the yard, and we're walking down, and I see this guy coming toward me from a distance, like 100 yards, and Mike McNabb and I are talking, and he's got sunglasses on, but I know he's looking directly at me. I could feel it, and he was not going to budge. And that was, to me, if metaphor is the right word or analogy, it was chicken. And I stepped out of his way because he was coming right toward me. And it's a kind of pecking order, And he smelled a rookie, a fish, as they called,
new Connors. Sure.
I remember I had a pea coat on.
The Navy watch cap.
That's what everybody wears. You didn't do time, did you, Mr. Mitchell?
not unless you have news for me. No, I did not.
But you know the outfit.
I'm from Detroit. I've seen a couple of movies. I know how this works. Okay. My guest, who in the history of the show is the only person to use the word shank, is Dustin Hoffman. His first film as director is Quartet. It's The Treatment, which you can hear at KCRW.com. But I find it fascinating, that movie, just because that's when you were going to direct. You got your friend and the guy you work with on stage, Ulu Grossbar,
yes,
to direct that film.
What happened was is that we started shooting at Folsom Prison, and it was extraordinary because you go up to Folsom, it was pre-production, and if you went at a certain time of year, there was a halo of fog around the prison, very low. And it's a Gothic-looking place. I mean, it's like out of the 1800s, Folsom. And that's where they sent lifers in those days, is the 70s. And we wanted to get that shot. Owen Roizman was a brilliant cinematographer, was shooting it. And then when we first saw it, locationing it, it was there. Now when we go to shoot and we get up in the morning, it's not there. And the decision you make is, you know, do you shoot anyway? And we didn't want to, so we tried to do other stuff. And 3 days went by, and we still didn't have that shot. Finally, I had to shoot without it. However, I go in the prison, we have a scene, and we're improvising. This was a script I got. This was my learning curve. Very talented writer. I don't want to say the name, because I finally got it after many delays and delays. I'll tell you after the interview. Very talented writer. And I get the script, and it's 250 pages long. And I said, why are you giving? And I said, I'm going to have to improvise this, you know, because they're forcing me to start shooting. And it's Billy Dee Williams. He didn't wind up in the movie. And Billy Dee Williams and I would be meeting in the yard and talking and improvising. And we did the shot over and over again. And the cinematographer, Owen Roizman, would shake his head like, that's a good take. Let's move on. And I had this extraordinary editor, Sam Osteen, you know, done The Graduate, and he's shaking his head negatively. Let's do another one. And if I look back on it, I think I was looking for an excuse to fire myself, and I did.
Really? What do you just think you weren't ready for? Just because of so many things that the exigencies just made it a situation you weren't ready to do?
I think more than anything, it was just my demons. Otherwise, it wouldn't have taken me another 30 years to finally do something.
When you first encountered the material Quartet, did you see it staged live?
Or
did
no.
you, okay, how did you end up finding the play?
I was doing Last Chance Harvey in London a few years ago with Emma Thompson, and it was a rather new director, and I think he'd done one film before, and the cinematographer was John de Borman, and John and I became friends.
Who shot this film?
That's correct. And he would say, do you like the way he set up the shot, or the way that I says, well, I was thinking, why isn't the camera, and back and forth, and he says, why aren't you directing? I said, well, that's a good question. I will say that Hollywood is a business, and it's reactive. In other words, if you haven't proven yourself as a director, then they tend not to send you scripts, even if you've been an actor for years. I think that's why Redford and Warren Beatty and people like that have developed their own material. And unless they really need you in the movie, and they say, okay, we'll let you direct it too. Anyway, it's just this, or they didn't want to send it to me because of my checkered reputation. So, meaning the line about me was I could take a Go project and put it into...
this is a turnaround, a development. You take a green light and turn it into development.
Yes. Turn a Go project into development. I'll take that. There are some cases like that, but they turn out to be great movies. Anyway, I said to John after we finished shooting, I said, geez, if you hear of anything, please, I'd love to come back here and work with you. I mean, it was 3 days before New Year's, 3 years ago. That's when I first read Quartet. And I'm getting ready to leave with my wife to come back to L.A., and it's the day before we're leaving, and I call him to say Happy New Year. And I said, remember, if you hear about anything, and he said, literally, he hung up the phone, and 5 minutes later, the phone rang, and it was Finola Dwyer, who had produced An Education and had this script that the second director had fallen out. And she said, I'm just asking people, John, if you want to suggest directors. And I just had that conversation with him. He quickly read it, liked it, sent it to me. I read it on the airplane, and that's how it happened.
It's the Treatment. I'm talking to Dustin Hoffman, whose career is probably less checkered than he thinks. His first film as director, a film he's not in, by the way, we'll talk about that too, is an adaptation of Ronald Harwood's Quartet. To some extent, a lot of things you've done, these guys could be either literally performance or performance is some part of the way they lead their lives. I mean, you think about Lenny, or I think the character in Agatha, who's kind of a performer who basically dresses and prepares himself as if he's going out on stage to deal with the world. Certainly Tootsie. Is the performance aspect of Quartet, given that it's about an old age home with opera performers, is that what attracted you to it, do you think?
Exactly. I mean, I do feel that I met Patty Chayefsky years and years and years ago, and I had an idea and I wanted him to write it. And he said, explain it to me. And as I started to explain it, he just looked at me because he was a no-nonsense guy. He says, you really don't want to do this movie, do you? I can tell by the way you're explaining it. I said, well, I thought I did, but he said, but you should know certain things that I'm, questions I'm asking, you should have answers to. And he said, how many movies you got in you that you're gonna, that you can direct? 5, 6, 7, 8. And he used the word bone marrow, I think. He said, you must pick something where it touches your bone marrow, where it's that close to you. And this film did. So that, I'm sure you're right. It's one of the things that I reacted to. I know what I do. I mean, you know, and that Tootsie was a satire in one sense about, you know, what you learn in class as opposed to, you know, what they make you do when you get the job. And what drew me, Tosca's Kiss is a documentary that Ronald Harwood saw and inspired him to write this. It's 40 minutes long, was done in 83, I think. You can get it online. And Verdi was very rich toward the end of his life, obviously. And he had met many opera singers and musicians that in their heyday had played La Scala and 30 years later couldn't pay the rent.
And this house that he built was going to be his legacy more than the music, he thought.
Yes. Wow. You know this stuff.
I have a lot of free time.
He actually said, this is the best thing I've ever done. My God. I understand that.
What do you mean you understand that?
I understand how self-critical we are, and it doesn't matter what the outside world says.
But I mean, I think for you, your point of view is the prism through which these characters you play, even we go back to Max in Straight Time, is they're kind of one person when they're alone. When they go into the world, they have to become someone else.
Yes.
And so many of the characters you play, even we go back to Benjamin in The Graduate, he tried to be like this other person in the world. He wasn't capable of doing it because he was just too callow a person.
Yes.
But he wanted to be able to, yes, to change that aspect of himself. And that's interesting because it becomes, in a way, you make self-criticism a part of these characters that you play.
You're good. Straight Time, what Eddie Bunker told me, and it was his answer to recidivism, he said, in The Joint, you can be somebody. Like that guy Mike McNabb. You could be in charge of gambling. You can work your way up. You can be, you know, you can have a certain reputation where you are a star in a sense. You go outside and you're an extra. And either on a conscious or unconscious level, guys are in fact, they call it summer vacation. That was a term that was used when you get paroled. I'm on summer vacation. In other words, they know they're coming back. And so, yes, they were. That's two different people. And you're right. I think, yes, with The Graduate, he was being asked to be a grown-up. And I've never wanted to be a grown-up, and I've never liked the term. Adult, yes, because an adult means, I think, that you're showing empathy outside yourself and you're helping others. A grown-up, I think, is a manufactured person. It's someone who says, yes, I wears a suit. And, you know, they put on a certain attitude that's, I think, an act. I'm a grown-up.
Wow. Okay. I'm sorry. We have to take a break. I will say yes because I'm merely a grown-up. My guest is Dustin Hoffman, who, strangely, first film as director is out now. It's Quartet, an adaptation of Ronald Harwood's play. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back to The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. I'm talking recidivism with Dustin Hoffman, whose first film as director is Quartet, but whose storied career goes from stage to screen. One of the more exciting things for me was getting a chance to see you on stage, seeing you. And I thought about when I saw the recent incarnation of Death of a Salesman, seeing you do it. We're talking about people who become who are one thing with other people and something else with everybody else. That's the definition of Willie Loman, is it not?
Yes. You know, I have never consciously thought of what you're saying. Yes, he was. I mean, here's the truth. I did it for two reasons. First of all, Ulu Grosbard directed a 33 long playing record, which they now call vinyl, of Death of a Salesman with the original, most of the original cast, meaning Lee J. Cobb and Mildred Donick, and he hired me to be Bernard, the kid next door who argues the case, you know, the Supreme Court, and I would read with actors, other actors he had to cast, and at the time, I said, my answers are too long.
No, they're not. Trust me on this.
It was View from the Bridge. Arthur Miller had made it into a two-act play. It starred Bob Duvall, and John Voight. It was a brilliant production, and I've met Arthur Miller, and that was my idol. Before I even thought about being an actor, I was given a book of plays in high school, Gassner, and the first play in it was Death of a Salesman, and I read it, and I broke down, and I couldn't tell anybody why I was crying. So I met Arthur Miller, and I would read as the Lee Cobb part to cast other actors, and apparently Arthur Miller had given a compliment to Ulu Grosbard, and Ulu said, one day he may play that part, and they told me that, and that made my month. Cut. Years pass. I'm living in Connecticut with my wife, and Arthur heard I put up a tennis court, and he actually came over and, reintroduced himself because we had just met in a spotty way, on View from the Bridge. And I had just finished Tootsie, and he had said to me, why don't you do Death of a Salesman? And I said, you're crazy. And then he told me that originally he conceived the part for a little guy. He said, as written, Willie was a little guy. He says, very much like the guy from the novel he wrote, I think, called Focus.
Yeah.
Same kind of little guy. And he said that the Linda, the wife, was he pictured as a really big, fulsome woman. And he got the opposite. He got Lee Cobb and he got Mildred Dunnock, who was a pencil, weighed about 80 pounds. So he said one thing to me, because I kept trying to find a way in. He said, I have to tell you that I would stop typing so many times because the character made me laugh, the contradictions of him. He said, there's a comedy in this. He says, the laughs are the jab, and you're going to set them up. Anyway, so he told me this story. He said, well, it was an amalgam of people, but he said that there was one part of him. One of his father's, Arthur Miller's, one of his father's best friends was a little guy who was married to a big woman. And he said what this guy would, and he was a salesman, quote unquote, always trying to get a laugh in any cheap way. And at one point, if he was not getting laughs when you visited him or over at his house or whatever, he would make a running jump to his over-bosomed wife who was sitting in a chair and pretend and jump in her lap and pretend to suckle milk from her. And when he said that, I said, I can play that part. Wow. I understood that. There was a pathetic thing in there, there was a human being in there. I could feel it. And I said, I'll do this if you're there every day on the casting and everything. I don't want to do this thing and have the critics say, we butchered you. They won't say that if they knew you were there every day. So he was there every day. We shut down pre-production to wait for John Malkovich, who came in and read. We had all these Biffs reading, every actor you could think of, James Patterson, whatever, all these different actors of the day, except De Niro, who I called up at that time, and I said, Robert, because I didn't know him, I said, I want you to play my son, Biff. And he said, you want me to be your son? He says, why don't I play Willie and you be my son? I'll never forget. He's a dear friend now. So he came there, and when I was reading with actors, I wore a vest. I just wanted to wear a vest. And his line when I talked to him after that the next day he was giving me his formal answer that he didn't want to do it. But he says, yeah, so he always talks, so I always think he starts every sentence with, so I see you're wearing this, only an actor would say this, I see you're wearing the vest and so on. It's actor talk. It's wonderful.
Well, my guest was more than just liked. He's well-liked, is Dustin Hoffman. His first film as director, which I guess we should talk about at some point, is the adaptation of Roland Harwood's Quartet. And Harwood has done so many interesting plays, which, again, so many pieces about performance. I mean, he adapted A Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, which is about guys having to be one thing with the guards and another thing amongst themselves. The Dresser, which is really about that kind of schism between who you are publicly and who you are personally.
And an autobiography, because he was that guy who was dressing Donald Wolfett in real life.
His trajectory and yours seemed a logical intersection, based on the way you both approach your work.
I never thought of it that way. I got to tell you one quick thing about Arthur, though.
Please, I'll go absolutely.
No. Arthur was there every day. We waited 3 months for Malkovich, because when he came in, all these actors came in to read, and when he read, you couldn't even hear him past the third row. He was waiting outside in Schubert Alley there, where everybody was sitting to read. He had sandals on. His feet were filthy. He later fixed his teeth because he was missing a lot of teeth. And he came to read with that scene with Happy, you know, and he says, you know, he's been away, and he saw a deer being born or whatever. A beautiful monologue. And it's one of those moments because Arthur had said he's a poet and he doesn't know it. He's a football star, but he's a poet and he lost his way. And he's doing this, and he's got it. And he did play football in high school, Malkovich. And I'm sitting behind Arthur, and he turns around and looks at me, and he just does a slow nod. And it makes me emotional to remember it, because he said, there's the guy. Right on the money. That's, you know, and he'd seen many Biffs. So we closed up production, pre-production, so Malkovich could go do a film with Bob Benton. And I think it was Sally.
Yeah, Places in the Heart. She won the Oscar for it.
Exactly. And we waited 3 months for him, and then we did it. And he was the most exciting thing to work with every day. It was just a genuine, wonderful experience for both of us. Anyway, Arthur was coming every day to see the show. And I remembered this for Quartet. Or many times, maybe not every performance, but many, many times he would be backstage in the wings. And one day I came, because he was checking up on us, and he was very upset because when Lee Cobb did it, and they got all these hosannas and all these great reviews because Ann directed it, that he said 6 weeks later it started to fall apart because everybody started to take stage. and suddenly, you know, it lost its tension. So one time he's right in the wings. I come off at the first act. First act is over. I come off. Other people are coming off. Everybody that's on stage comes off. And I look at him and I say, Arthur, he's seen it many times. I said, that's like one of the best that's ever gone. And he shakes his head negatively and he disagrees. And I said, why? And he looks at his watch and he says, you ran 3.5 minutes longer than you should. I told the cast this on Quartet. And I said to him, but Arthur, they're laughing. You got to wait for the laugh to subside. You don't want to talk your lines through. He says, I don't care. I says, really?
So he said, talk over the laughter.
I said, but what if they don't hear some of it? Then they don't hear some of it. And then he said, I want them on the edge of their seat. I don't want them leaning back. He says, you must keep the tension of this play and force them. And I remembered that, and I tried to do Quartet like that. And I put it another way. I would say we try when we're doing a scene. Can we do this scene? Can we do this scene so no one in the auditorium says, "Do you want some popcorn?" You know, can you hold an audience?
Wow,
and that was a gift.
So you had to feel like it was on a clock, because that's funny. Because I feel like each of the actors who, in some way, are playing themselves. I know Billy Connolly a little bit.
Yes,
and in real life, he is kind of a strolling player.
That's right.
Charmed his way through everything.
Yes,
and Michael Gambon, who I've seen on stage a few times, he's an actor whose pride comes through in every character he plays.
Yes,
this time it comes through his vanity, but he often, I should say, plays very proud people. people. The fun of watching is that you've got these actors to sort of play what we, from the ones I know, are kind of playing versions of themselves, and that's really kind of a wonderful thing.
I haven't heard anybody else know that, say that. They didn't know that. And I said, not only do I not want you to play characters, but I want you to play yourself as you are today. We're all in our 70s. We can now see the end of the tunnel. And if we can put on the screen what that feels like, having given 40, 50 years to our art, and now be on a descent simply because the roles aren't there. We've been stars for a long, long time. And once you get into your 50s, you're playing the supporting part. And you get into your 60s and 70s, you start to do a cameo. No one's writing leading parts unless, unfortunately, you carry a gun. And you can have a longer career that way. That's the way we define masculinity, unfortunately. So that's Tom Courtney was reading poetry on the radio, BBC, when I met him. He didn't want to act anymore. He couldn't stand the parts that were given to him. I think he was finishing a movie, but he was very disheartened. Maggie, if you read the London Times, because I Googled everybody and learned, like you, I did as much research as I could to learn about them. She gave a London Sunday Times interview a few years ago where she talked openly about chemo and radiation and was so tired she lost all her passion for her work, and she said that's it. And then 2 years later she started working again and she's never stopped. And I said, those two people are the gal I'd love you to be able to put on screen, those two sides of yourself. And so you're right, and that's what we tried to do. And after I saw the documentary, I did say to John, I said, if we can get permission to use real opera singers and real musicians retired, then we can infiltrate or filter our stars in with these people, and that will encourage them not to, quote, act, because the people around them, I'm not going to ask them to act or even want them to act. They are just, you know, who they are. No one had rung their phone in 30 years. It was so moving to hire these people. Ronnie Hughes, the trumpet player, 83 years old when he did it, so he's probably 86 now, had not lost an ounce of his chops, and he could not get a job. And everybody does their own playing, as he does, or their own singing. If I continue, I'll start crying. I don't want to do that. I'll only do that if you're photographing. Don't you love it in movies that when the actor starts crying, he never wipes away the tear because it's gold? In life, we always wipe our eyes.
This has been gold. Mr. Hoffman, I'm sorry, we're out of time. Will you please come back to the show again?
Yes, tomorrow. I'm having a good time with you.
Okay, we'll find an occasion for you. My guest making his directorial debut at the tender age of 75 is Dustin Hoffman. It's been such a pleasure having you. Please come back.
Mr. Mitchell, is wonderful to be sitting
with you. It's my pleasure. I'm not wiping my tear now. This is gold. Our recording engineer at KCRW in Santa Monica is J.C. Swadek, who also mixed the show. It's edited and produced by Jenny Radelet. I've learned so much today. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. Stay tuned for All Things Considered on KCRW and KCRW.com.
Find past episodes of The Treatment at kcrw.com or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Listen to The Treatment on demand on your smartphone with KCRW's apps. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.